coming up on KUCB News. The Raiders are headed to the state basketball tournament, and John Lucking returns to Onalaska as interim police chief. Stay tuned.
Programming on KUCB is made possible by Redfish Electronics, now providing new, used, and refurbished computers, tablets, iPods, MP3s, phones, phone accessories, and flat screens. We also carry external hard drives for your digital storage needs. Redfish Electronics is located in the airport parking lot next to Northport Rentals. Redfish Electronics can be reached at 359-2205.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Zoe Sobel with some local news on Monday, March 11th, 2019. Onalaska's basketball teams are headed to the state tournament. The Raider boys won their region this weekend after knocking off top seed Point Hope 75-73. Coach Riley Spetz calls the victory miraculous as his team was trailing by 10 in the fourth quarter.
The stars kind of aligned in more ways than one. You know, you could say, you know, they had a couple kids foul out, and we had some kids hit big shots, and the ball seemed to bounce our way for about 2 minutes at the end of the game when we needed it to bounce our way. The kids were pretty resilient, and I'm real proud of them for that.
Reigning 2A Player of the Year Trevor Wilson scored 38 points and 10 rebounds in the contest, while Torrance Lee chipped in another dozen. Spetz says his team's strong finish was especially satisfying as the Harpooners were undefeated at the time.
At this point in the year, we kind of expect to beat anybody, you know, and we expect to compete and have a chance in every single game and play the way we know we can play. And I'm glad the boys got it done. But I think beating an undefeated team, that's pretty sweet. But doing it in the regional final is even better.
On their way to the regional title, the boys also narrowly beat Unalakleet 64-62. Now the Raiders are turning their focus to the state tournament, which begins on Thursday. The girls' team is also headed to state. Coach Casey Clausius says it's their second year in a row after many seasons failing to clinch bids.
It was tough work for everybody, you know, trying to get back here again, and everybody had to stay healthy and had to be on board with getting the practice on time and balancing schoolwork. And it was just a lot of work for the girls to get back here, and we're excited.
The Raiders finished the regional tournament second, earning an automatic bid to state. Along the way, they knocked off Unalakleet twice. In the first matchup, Onalaska took a commanding 72-53 victory. In the second contest, it was a closer 59-50 win. Clausius says the girls also played a tight game with defending 2A state champion Point Hope, losing by only 5 points.
They were just so close. It was just come down to some small plays, knowing who you're guarding in crucial situations, or knowing what offense you're running in that exact moment. And just so many small things. It wasn't a lot of them. It was just some small things that decided the game, and we just came up short on the scoreboard.
While Clausius is hoping his team gets another crack at the Harpooners, they'll face Nenana in the first round at state. The teams met last year with Nenana winning 71-47. KUCB will air live coverage of state basketball starting Thursday morning at 8 o'clock with the boys taking on Hooper Bay. And the call will continue at 11 o'clock as the girls go up against Nenana. Former Onalaska Police Chief John Lucking is back on the job. The city has hired Lucking to serve as interim head of the Department of Public Safety following Jennifer Shockley's resignation last month. KUCB's Laura Craigle has more on the temporary contract and the continued search for a full-time police chief.
John Lucking first worked as a police officer in Onalaska in the 1980s. He eventually became chief, though he left the community in the early 2000s to head up police departments in Soldotna and Sam Point. Now Lucking is back in Onalaska on a six-month contract. According to the agreement, he'll serve as interim police chief through the end of August or until the city makes a full-time hire, whichever comes first. The position has been open since Mike Holman retired in January of 2018. City officials had postponed the hiring process during a heated debate over department restructuring, but the search is back on following the decision to separate public safety into two standalone departments. Lucking's contract says he'll assist in efforts to recruit a permanent police chief, and when the time comes, stay on an extra 10 days to help smooth that transition. He'll earn almost $20,000 a month for his work, which includes day-to-day management of the police force. Although he just started last Monday, Lucking is off-island this week on a pre-planned vacation. KUCB has an interview scheduled with him upon his return and will bring Unalaskans more information after that. Meanwhile, City Manager Thomas E. Thomas has not responded to multiple requests for comment on the staffing changes happening at City Hall or on the transition underway at Public Safety. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Craigle.
The city is hosting a public meeting tonight with the architects assessing Public Safety's 30-year-old building. The design firm Jensen Yorba Lot was hired by the city last year to analyze the building's usage before making recommendations to address issues of limited space, outdated equipment, and confidentiality concerns. Depending on the findings, city officials say they'll probably consider an expansion and renovation to the current building or construction of a new building in addition to retrofitting the existing structure. The architects' meeting starts tonight at 6 o'clock at City Hall and is expected to run until 8. The first fighter pilot to land on Attu and Shemya Islands died last week following a bout with cancer. To remember Lieutenant Colonel Bob Brocklehurst, we're re-airing his conversation with Tara Bordakovsky, whose grandmother survived the internment at Funder Bay. As many World War II veterans have never spoken with evacuees or their descendants or vice versa, 2 years ago, KUCB invited them to sit down together. A note to listeners, one of the people in this story uses a word that is offensive for Japanese people.
We were 21 years old then, most of us. The oldest could have been 27, and we were ready to go. We wanted to fly, and we wanted to just come on down the Aleutian. I don't think anybody in my squadron thought anything about being afraid. You were there to do your job. It was war. That's all we thought about.
My experience of the whole evacuation and the internment time comes from that perspective of my grandmother, who was interned in Funder Bay, you know, the Aleuts of St. Paul, and specifically her. I was probably about 21 years old when I found out about it. And she would talk, but I could tell that it was difficult. And she would only talk for so long, and then she would just have to stop. And, you know, so I didn't really push her, but she did want to tell her story. She did want other elders to get up and talk about it, and she did realize how important it was for us to know our own history, to hear what happened to the Aleuts, the Unangans here in Alaska. There are other communities, the Unangan communities that were equally impacted and affected by this, and I know very, very little about their experiences. I wonder a lot about Attu and those Aleuts that were taken as prisoners of war over to Japan, and, you know, where...
See, I didn't know that at the time. We didn't know that.
Uh-huh.
When I got there, our army was still fighting three battle areas.
So, Bob, when you were in Attu during that time...
I was the first fighter pilot to land on Attu and on Shemya, yes, ma'am.
And when you were there at that point, were the Aleuts already taken as prisoners of war at that point?
I never heard anything about the natives. I often wondered what happens to the natives up here. I flew into Atka, I flew into Adak, and you never heard anything or seen anything about the natives. It was always in my mind, what happened to it? I didn't know about the evacuation of the natives and that they were sent to other places in Alaska. And, of course, up here I learned the story of the elders as you describe it, a very touching story.
Hmm. What I always have kind of mixed emotions and thoughts about all these years growing up has to do with the profound and deep respect that my grandmother, Mary Bordakovsky, had for the military. I think I've heard that per capita Alaska Native serve at the highest rates, and among the Alaska Native, the Aleuts are the highest serving. And so maybe that's where some of that respect comes from, because my grandfather was Alaska Territorial Guard and my dad, Vietnam veteran. And yet at the same time, when I was learning about what happened during World War II, there would always be these horrific stories about the shape of the homes and the damage that was done and the personal items that were stolen and whatnot at the hands of our own, the military. And so the two scenarios that have grown up with have always kind of presented in my mind a little bit of a wow, I don't know. I respect the military, and yet I also feel badly that something like that happened by our own military. I'm not even sure what my question would be.
At the time we came up here, the impression we were given, and this is voiced oral stuff, that we had nothing to stop the Japanese. They figured that the Japanese, if they had wanted to, could have come clear up in the Aleutians, taken Anchorage, and come down the east coast of Anchorage, down Vancouver to Seattle, Washington. So we were rushed up there as an additional squadron with the 18th that was up here. And the impression was given right along that if the Japs came, we were all there. We were the only force there to stop them, and we probably couldn't have with that limited force. And I was talking to my son last night, and I was thinking, you know, we didn't have much choice but to move the Aleut natives out because they could all have become prisoners of the Japanese or killed. It was probably the best thing that we could do to save the native population. It was done very poorly, sent to a bad place, and certainly wasn't handled professionally. But I still think that it was probably still the best thing to do. It's just too bad that we couldn't handle it properly.
Bob Brocklehurst was 98. He died Wednesday in Pennsylvania. The state legislature adopted a citation Wednesday recognizing the contributions of Tlingit Code Talkers during World War II. Representatives and senators spoke about the outsized role that Alaska Natives have played in the military. KHNS's Henry Leisha has more.
Any history buff would know of the Navajo Code Talkers that developed secret battle communications for the U.S. military. But until recently, few people knew that Tlingit soldiers also used their language to pass along secret information during World War II. Former state legislator and Sea Alaska board member Bill Thomas says he was friends with Robert Jeff David and George Lewis, two former Tlingit Code Talkers that lived in Haines. He didn't know the role they played in the war until after they passed away.
We all like to brag about what we did, and neither one of these two could say a word. And I'm totally surprised, you know, that these two were able to hold that secret and not let their children or their wives or anybody know that what they did.
Code Talker missions were highly classified, and the number of Tlingit people who served in this capacity is unknown. In 2013, Thomas attended a ceremony in Washington, D.C., where Congress awarded silver medals to five deceased Tlingit Code Talkers. 6 years have passed since the medals were awarded, and Thomas felt it was time that the state of Alaska recognized the soldiers' efforts as well.
It'd been too long, as far as I was concerned. I felt it was disappointing not to recognize these men and their significance they had in the war effort.
Thomas and Sea Alaska Heritage recently proposed a legislative citation recognizing the importance of Tlingit Code Talkers. Several senators pointed out Alaska Natives' high rate of participation in the U.S. military before adopting the citation on Wednesday. Senator Jesse Keel said he found it ironic that Native languages were used as a tool in the military while they were suppressed in civilian life.
Many of those Native Americans who served our country so nobly and who saved so many lives with their rapid communications in unbreakable code were punished for using their Native languages in schools when they had been younger.
Thomas says five flags at the Capitol building will fly at half-mast in honor of the five known Tlingit Code Talkers. The flags will then be presented to the families of the Code Talkers on Monday the 18th during the gold medal basketball tournament at Juno Douglas High School. In Haines, I'm Henry Leisha.
The Iditarod is heating up as mushers have reached the coast. As of this morning, Pete Kaiser, your Life Seth Olsom, and Nick Petit are leading the way. One of the customary quirks in the dog mushing world is that when a new litter of puppies is born, oftentimes there will be a theme to the names they are given. For example, Nick Petit has dogs from a litter named after champion Iditarod mushers. Libby, for example, is short for Libby Riddles, the first woman to win the race. This is a topic that delights Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes, and in Takotna, he recently found his new favorite examples.
I like litter names because they're usually funny. Sometimes kind of self-referential and creative. A friend of mine in Nome had one litter named for cuts of beef, so ribeye, flank, and brisket. Another set of his dogs had weather-themed names like rainy, windy, and flood. It's a lot more elemental. Rookie Blair Braverman, who's a writer, has a set of dogs named after famous authors. So Hunter S. Thompson, Gay Talese, and James Baldwin, those are some of them. Another litter she has is named after characters from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, a beloved movie and TV series from the 90s. But I have to say, so far, my favorite theme is Matt Fahler's heavy metal litter.
This is Iron Maiden. This is Pink Floyd. Pantera. Led Zeppelin and Ronnie James Dio, and those are the heavy metal bands. And then my buddy Michael Baker, who's running our two-year-old slash B team, he has the hair metal, the glam rock, David Bowie, Billy Idol.
Twisted Sister.
Twisted Sister. Did you meet them already?
No, I'm just guessing. White Snake. Is White Snake in there?
We had a White Snake. We turned her into a pet dog. She wasn't really enjoying the 1,000-mile perspective. So she's a pet dog in Michigan. And then I can't think of the other name. Oh, Van Halen, Motley Crue, and Bon Jovi. Yeah.
Poetic.
Gotta love the 80s.
The hair metal theme's cute, kind of kitschy. But I think the idea of naming a bunch of sled dogs after heavy metal bands like Pantera is funny. Because the style of music, that heavy, sludgy, doomy whole genre, it's like the complete opposite of mushing in the middle of wilderness. But if that's the excuse you need to yell out things like G, Iron Maiden, or Ha, Twisted Sister, then I'm all for it.
And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Zoe Sobel. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org. Please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecast.